Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
So, hello Felicity, how are you today?
I'm great. So we're recording this episode just before Christmas, so we're building up to the holiday season, and we've just ordered 4 boxes of mince pies. And how are you?
So 4 boxes just for the two of you, or are you planning on sharing
them? No. So we're in Germany, so there's 2 boxes for us and there's 2 boxes to distribute to neighbours who need to understand how a proper Christmas is run.
Ah, good. Glad you're pulling off the mince pie tradition in Germany.
Yes, that's right. So we're going to teach the Germans who came up with the whole Christmas thing about doing a proper Christmas.
Good. Glad to hear it.
What about you?
Well, Christmas tree is up, and you'll be pleased to know that this year's Christmas tree theme in the Halstead household is mojito on the beach.
What? You have drinks-related Christmas tree themes?
Yep, and it changes every year. So this year, the baubles are green and turquoise and white with a little hint of orange. We've got starfish, ice cubes, well, kind of plastic ones, glasses, lime slices, and of course, tropical flowers, because we're mojito on the beach. And then, of course, all rounded off by 36 miniature bottles of rum, which are actually Bacardi. So perhaps I should have got them to sponsor it.
Well, hang on a second. What do you do with the decorations once Christmas is over? Like, do you have a warehouse full of drinks themed Christmas decorations? What do you do?
Well, kind of, yes, actually. So building up over the years, yes. So I've got baubles of all different types of colours that you can imagine. And then I've got fake glasses and ice cubes. But then I've got peacock feathers from when we had Bombay Sapphire. Thistles and tartan bows from Highland Sling. Champagne corks from Champagne Fizz. And even coffee bean decorations that I made when we had espresso martini.
You know, one day somebody's going to have to clean out your estate, and you know what they're going to think of you when they look at your Christmas decorations?
Yeah, it is going to be slightly mad. But anyway, we are not talking about rum, even though
we've just been talking about rum.
We are not talking about rum today. Today's question actually comes from my friend Helen, who is based in London.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know you're going to say, is Helen a real person, Luli? Yes, Helen is a real person, Felicity, and she is actually based in London.
Okay, I believe you.
Yeah.
But can I also say, I'm so impressed about how many of your friends need to know more about drinks. Our podcast would not exist without your friendship circle. And in fact, I've decided that after Christmas, I'm going to go around and survey my own friends and relatives just so I can keep up.
Good. Well, that will be good. So back to Helen. And she was asking the following question. So Helen is a big fan of gin, and she's been really loyal to certain brands over the years. And let's just say Helen is quite particular or with precision when it comes to how she likes her gin and tonic served, the amount of tonic, the type of garnish. So she's a kind of real kind of committed and dedicated gin drinker. So in a recent conversation, she posed the following question. I'm sure I used to see more people drinking gin and there were more choices available 5 years ago compared with today. So she says, has the gin boom gone away? And if so, why?
Okay, so first of all, can I say how much I approve of your friend? Because I really love the gin and tonic. It's my absolute favourite drink. I'm not going to decorate my tree with it, but I do love it a lot.
Okay, so what is it then about gin that appeals to you?
I think it's not just the gin, it's the tonic water as well. And I think it's the bitterness. And it's also one of the easiest sort of flavour profiles for the non-alc producers to replicate. So there's some really good non-alc versions around. So I've been drinking a lot of Tanqueray 00 recently. What about you, Luli? Are you a gin person?
I am. So when I'm looking for a longer drink, so a kind of spirit in a mixer, gin and tonic would be my go-to. But I kind of have to confess, I'm not sure I could really tell the difference between gins, the flavours, particularly after I put the tonic in. I'm sure if I tasted them side by side, I probably could. But I guess that's something that you don't normally do.
Well, you know, I must say I don't go in for gin brands particularly. I just typically, you know, buy whatever the bar person recommends. Okay, so let's start by reminding ourselves, what is gin? What is it, Lily?
Okay, so from a product point of view, gin is made from a neutral, flavourless grain spirit, so alcohol, ethanol, and that's distilled multiple times to give this sort of pure, bland, high alcohol liquid, so 95 to 96 ABV, which is the alcohol by volume. So for our friends in the US, that would be 190 to 192 proof, which is the proof system, is the way that in America we measure alcohol levels. So in the EU, it's legally required that gin is made from this neutral spirit. But if we contrast that, for example, to the US, distillers can use any distilled spirit for gin, which gives a broader flavour and variety profile.
That is so interesting, because I would have expected it was the other way around, because, you know, I know that for some strange reason, gin hasn't taken off in America the way it has elsewhere, and yet they've got more possibilities. So, yeah, okay, interesting. So, but I have to say, nothing that you described sounds very appealing, Lulu.
No. Well, gin is more than this neutral spirit. So to qualify as a gin, botanicals, so those are flavours that we derive from natural ingredients like juniper and seeds and citrus, they're added to the neutral spirit. It's redistilled to extract those flavours of the botanicals. So according to the WSET, Wine and Spirit Education Trust, who are the global leader in both wine and spirit education, and sidebar, full disclosure, I'm a trustee of the WSET. Anyway, they say in their textbook, Spirits textbook, juniper is the only botanical legally required to be present in gin. And there's no limit to what other botanicals a distiller can use. So they go on to state, in recent years, distillers have exploited the freedom and legislation to create this huge variety of different flavours and styles of gin. They also say it's possible to make gins by adding artificial flavours, but the best gins are made by redistillation.
Okay, so that's the thing that makes different gins distinctive. It's the botanical recipe that's the redistillation.
Absolutely, yeah. So each brand has kind of their own recipe, their own botanical recipe. And once the recipe has been established, the distiller can choose whether to distill some or all of the botanicals individually.
Okay, but the thing that is consistent with all of them is they must have juniper.
Yeah, correct. And without going too much of a tangent, I actually did a whole ton of research last year on juniper.
Okay, so that doesn't surprise me, since you decorate your Christmas trees with mojitos, but you will have to tell me, what were you doing researching juniper?
Okay, so I was looking to see if I could grow juniper at our vineyard in Sussex in England. So, I had this mad idea that I wanted to produce a gin that was only based on locally sourced botanicals. So obviously, in which case I'd need to grow and farm juniper. You'd have to have juniper and gin. And to be quite honest, I didn't really know what juniper was, well, kind of horticulturally speaking, and how it was grown and farmed.
Well, luckily for you, I know absolutely nothing about juniper berries. So this gives you an opening to explain to me what you discovered.
Well, first of all, I learned that actually, technically speaking, it's misleading to call them juniper berries, because a juniper berry is actually the female cone. And it's got lots of flesh on it, so it kind of looks like a fruit, which is why we call it a berry. And also that the juniper that's most widely used in gin production is juniper communis, so that's a small tree or shrub that can live for kind of up to 200 years. And these cones take actually two seasons, so 2 years to ripen. So the first year they're green, and then the second year they're ripe before they're harvested. And we need both male and female plants to get to this cone fruiting bit.
So if you'd planted it, you would have had to wait quite a long time for the first harvest.
Yeah, actually, yes. But interestingly, actually, the economics of juniper is even more complex than that. So the vast majority of juniper that's used in gin isn't actually farmed or cultivated in that kind of traditional sense. Most of it's harvested from naturally growing wild plants that thrive in actually lots of parts of the world, but include Kosovo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Albania, Macedonia, Italy. So in these places, a lot of it's picked in the wild by individuals who sell to the large spice companies. And their method of harvesting is really time consuming. So basically the pickers go out into the wild with a basket or a tarp under the branch and whack the trees, the bushes with a stick to try and dislodge those dark berries, ripe berries or cones, leaving the younger green fruit alone.
That's extraordinary. I mean, that sounds very uneconomic. So you have to go around, you have to do it by hand, you hit it with sticks, and you've got to rely on wild shrubs to produce. So how does that work from a sustainability or an economic perspective? Because everybody in the world needs juniper.
Yeah, exactly. And without getting too deep into this tangent of juniper, you know, in some places, so in the UK, for example, juniper is actually an endangered species
right.
due to a combination of kind of disease and impacts from the natural environment where it grows. But we are seeing kind of more farmers who are now cultivating juniper as a commercial crop.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And it reminds me of the one single thing I know about juniper berries, which is that they've been affected by climate change because they suffer when there's drought. Oh, actually, no, I know two things. I read recently that someone established a juniper berry farm in Australia. So listen to this. This is from ABC News. Quote, efforts are underway to encourage more Australian farmers to grow juniper berries to make gin. And in the New South Wales Snowy Mountains, agricultural scientist and farmer Lucy Vincent is on a mission to do just that. She's growing juniper berries and supplying them to a distillery on the New South Wales far south coast in a bid to turn the industry away from imported berries. Damn right. I think the Australian berries will be fantastic, and it sounds like it'll be environmentally better.
Yeah, because of course we've got this shipping of berries around the world at the moment. So I've taken us right down this juniper rabbit hole, so to speak. So getting back on topic, gin. We've understood the basics of gin and juniper, but what about the history of gin, its origins? I know it's something to do with the Netherlands, but...
Yes, so most histories of gin say that it sort of arose out of medicinal drinks. Mm. Then came something called Genever, a juniper-based spirit, and this was created by Dr. Franciscus Silvius, who was a 17th century Flemish doctor who's considered one of the fathers of modern chemistry. And what he did was he mixed juniper berries, herbs and alcohol as a cure for heartburn. It was clearly something of a hit because people started drinking it for non-medicinal purposes.
So seriously, did it cure heartburn?
I cannot imagine that it had anything to do with curing heartburn, but maybe after drinking it, people just didn't care about their symptoms anymore. Anyway, so the Dutch, of course, were a great trading nation, and sailors took the drink with them and thus spread it. But what really caused the gin boom in England was the so-called Glorious Revolution, which was when King James II was deposed by his daughter Mary, and of course she had a Dutch husband, William of Orange. At the time, there were restrictions on French brandy. It was one of those, French-English things that was going on.
One of the moments.
And so it all kicked off with gin. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the world of drinks, uncovering the drivers of the market. It's an interesting topic, but we've got a driver of our own.
That's right, Felicity. We're using this podcast to share our knowledge and experience.
So let me introduce you to the amazing Luli Halsted. She spent more than 30 years working with wine and spirits businesses around the world. Anybody who knows her knows she's not just a globally respected researcher, but she's a complete data nerd who specializes in understanding drinks trends, consumers, and how to build drinks brands that are profitable. She spent her career focusing on understanding the motivations behind why we drink what we do and what drives our choices. I met her back in 2008 when she was wowing an audience in Sweden with her insights, and she's awesome.
Wow, that's very kind and kind of quite humbling, Felicity, so thank you. Let me introduce you. So Felicity Carter, as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, is internationally renowned and award-winning journalist, editor, and researcher. And she's worked in Europe, the US, UK, Australia. She is one of the most respected authorities on the international wine business. She goes into businesses and sorts out their communication strategies, whether they want a better way to speak to customers or they want to develop a content strategy. And most people don't know about her is that she's also a ghostwriter of books.
So we became friends through our shared passion for understanding the underlying trends and future opportunities in drinks.
Yes, indeed we did, Felicity, and that's why we started this podcast, A Question of Drinks. And you can get in touch if you'd like us to help your drinks business navigate future opportunities and, most importantly, set out a strategy to grow profitably.
And we come as separate individuals.
We do indeed. You can find us both on LinkedIn, Felicity Carter or Luli Halstead, or please connect and drop either of us a DM.
Or get in touch via aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
Ah, so that's where we get to what's called the gin craze.
Yes, and interestingly, it seems to have been literally a craze. So by the early 18th century, there were more than 7,000 places
wow.
in London alone that were selling gin that we know
wow.
of. There were probably more. And as you might expect, people went from drinking, you know, beer to drinking distilled spirits, and crime and disorder soared, which was captured in numerous literary and artistic references of the day.
Okay, so that's like Hogarth's famous Gin Lane woodcut, where you kind of see the infants falling out of the arms of drunken women.
Yeah, and there was a terrible wave of babies born with fetal alcohol syndrome,
wow.
or babies that just died, because mothers would quieten them by giving them gin. And there was even the case of a woman called Judith Defour who killed her baby so she could sell its clothes to buy more gin.
Goodness me. So the government must have cracked down on this, I'm assuming.
Well, they tried. They tried. They introduced numerous gin acts, which you know, involve fines, licensing laws and so on. But in order to enforce them, they needed people to inform on each other. So it damaged social relations, it damaged faith in the government, and it didn't slow down the drinking. People found lots of ways to get around the laws. Like they created these early vending systems where you'd go and tap on a wall and you'd say a password and a human being on the other side of the wall would pour gin. It was extraordinary.
Wow. So then kind of what happened? How did that end?
Well, it wasn't through the laws of man. It was the laws of nature. The grain harvest of 1757 failed and there just wasn't the grain available for distilling. So drinking spirits became expensive and people moved on to beer, and that's when you get the rise of the pub. Interestingly, later on that century, you start to get the emergence of gin brands like Tanqueray and Gordon's. So I guess the rise in prices led to what we would now call premiumisation, which led to a professionalisation of the gin trade. And then you also see technological improvements in stills, and so you start to get the emergence of distinct styles like the London dry gin. So let's go back to your friend Helen, who definitely exists and really is called Helen. Where are we now in terms of how much we drink?
Okay, so if we look at gin consumption, so two of the major growth markets that we've seen over the recent years are Spain and the UK. So if we look at the UK, in 2023, there were 5.3 million 9-litre cases of gin sold in the UK, and that's according to data from IWSR.
Okay, so I think in wine bottles, I don't really know what that means. Can you tell me how many serves of gin that is?
Okay, yeah. So our 5.3 million cases in the UK, this is, equates to 1.4 billion serves of gin. That's if we're assuming a 35cl measure, which is one of the kind of legal sizes of measure for a pub. But, you know, if we're pouring at home, might be a different size. But yeah, so there's 1.4 billion serves of gin in the UK last year in 2023. So gin's more impressive recent growth, Helen, our questioner is based in the UK, has come from Spain and the UK. So in Spain, it was kind of really took off around sort of 2008-09. And in the UK, it was more like 2013-14 where we saw this.
Okay, can I interject? Because I recently read an Economist article about the gin boom in the UK, which they call the ginnaissance. So I can't answer for what happened in Spain, but I can tell you what happened in the UK.
Yeah, go for it. Dive in.
Okay, so in 2007, these three guys, Sam Goldsworthy, Fairfax Hall and Jared Brown, tried to set up a company using a 300-litre still. And this is according to a November 2024 article. But they couldn't do it because of those 18th century gin acts. So they campaigned to get the law repealed, which they did in 2008. So when they started, Sipsmith, their company, was only one of 12 gin companies in the UK. But because of that repeal of the law, within a very short time, there were gin producers springing up everywhere. And in fact, I remember going to the London Wine Fair about 2010, 2011, and asking where the woman was who usually ran the press office. And I was told that she'd left to start a gin company and she was making money hand over fist.
Okay. Yeah, really interesting. So back to something we were talking about earlier then, we haven't really talked about tonic water and how gin and tonic itself evolved. Now I know this one.
Now, I know there's something about this. This is to do with British soldiers in India who drank it to keep away malaria, wasn't it?
Yeah, it turns out that's only partly true, which I know because Kew Gardens here in London, they've been doing some kind of myth-busting about this recently, and they've even actually launched a book called Just the Tonic by Kim Walker and Mark Nesbitt.
Okay, so what's the real story?
So the real story is about quinine and its anti-malarial properties. But that comes from the bark of the Andean fever tree, which is actually found natively in South America. So although malaria is now confined mostly to the tropics, it used to be everywhere, actually, including Britain, including
really?
The UK. Yeah. But then it disappeared in places like the UK because of the better water management.
Oh, they drained the swamps.
Yeah, exactly. But during the empire period, so Europeans went to Africa, were dying from malaria in huge numbers.
Right.
So in 1854, a Scottish doctor called William Balfour Beatty was on one of these expeditions to Niger and used quinine to prevent malaria.
Oh, right. Rather than using it as a treatment.
Yeah, exactly. So this opened up the new possibilities for colonization. So the seeds and plants were taken from South America to places like India and Java. And then we get the British mixing gin and tonic.
So what you're saying is that tonic water actually became a tool of conquest. That's an amazing piece of drinks history. And of course, that raises the question of fever tree, which is also part of the story of the recent UK gin boom. So two guys, Tim Warrilow, and I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong, and Charles Rolls launched their tonic water brand in 2004 with the key insight that Schweppes had been the unrivaled giant in the market, threatened only by supermarket own brand. And so they'd focused on price. But these two could see that that as spirits were premiumizing, they needed a premium water. So they decided to flavor on they decided to focus on flavour and quality, and they happened to catch the upswing in the gin market. But, of course, what goes up must come down, and today there are literally dozens of gin companies. But recently the costs of glass and grain have soared and there's now a new duty levied on gin, so the shine has gone off the boom.
So just on that fever tree and thinking about, do you think it was the premium tonic that drove the increase in gin consumption, or do you think it was did it push or pull? Which one came first?
That's interesting. I haven't read anything other than it was just this fantastic timing issue that these two things came together. But I'm sure that it must have driven it to a certain extent because fever tree is really, really good. Now, I've tried some, supermarket own brand tonic water, and the problem with them is they're full of sugar and you can taste it. And the thing about quinine is because it's so bitter, it's got to be balanced with sugar, but you shouldn't notice the sugar. And I think it's not that easy a drink to make really, really well. So I'm guessing, I don't know, but I'm guessing it was just one of those happy coincidences.
Okay. I'm wondering whether they were just super smart and saw the trajectory of the premiumization of spirits.
It's definite. In interviews they've done, they definitely saw that.
Yeah.
I guess it was in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. Thinking about the peak of gin then, following on from that, which was in kind of 2020 in the UK. So that's and when we saw the peak of volume. But we've seen quite sharp declines, actually, in the volume of gin in markets like the UK since 2020 and particularly since 2023. So IWSR forecasts, again, if we're looking at that, they are suggesting a kind of minus 5% CAGR, so a decline, particularly for premium plus gin between 2023 and 2028 in those what had been strong growth markets of Spain and the UK. So according to Dan Metier, who's a research director at IWSR, he said, quote, "The extent of gin's contraction in Spain during 2023, despite record tourist growth, was a clear indication that not only in Spain, but across most of Europe, the momentum for gin and tonic is over." So if we put that into a global context, we saw these kind of peaks and then we're seeing it falling back significantly, around 7% CAGR for gin globally in 2023. And looking ahead, IWSR forecasts that for gin globally, there'll be a small increase in volume. So, you know, kind of 1% CAGR, but, you know, up to 2028. But that's pretty small and certainly not at the growth levels, for example, that Helen was talking about in her question.
Okay, so if the volume of gin in key markets like UK and Spain is falling, where's this growth going to come from?
Well, if we look in recent years, we've seen actually strong growth, again, based on IWSR data in markets like France and Italy. If we take India as an example, we're seeing a craft gin renaissance in India. And again, Jason Holloway from IWSR says, quote, "Gin has proven to be the ideal platform for local flavours and ingredients in India. Craft gins have emerged with momentum sustained post-pandemic as well." So it's not just the international gins brands that are growing in India, but actually local and domestic production. And then we could take a different market, somewhere, a different country. So Japan, for example. And again, we're seeing existing familiarity with local consumers in Japan really helping there, because gin and tonic is one of the best known long drinks in Japan, again, according to IWSR data.
I suppose it makes sense because almost uniquely among spirits, you can add the local flavour by using local herbs. So one gin that I'm really keen on, and I'm not sure if I pronounce it correctly, is Himimbri from Iceland, which my mate Alba Hoff distills. And it's made from thermal waters in Iceland, but also Icelandic or Arctic herbs. And it's quite unusual.
Wow.
And of course, that means that, you know, these products are unique, which in the spirits world is a coveted position to be in, because so many products, you know, can be reproduced. It's interesting. All right. So what about markets like the US?
Yeah, well, you talked about the US actually right at the beginning, didn't you? Saying, oh, you know, gin hasn't taken off in the same way in the US. But yeah, we should talk about the US because, yes, we haven't seen those same kind of really strong growth rates in gin that Helen's talking about in the UK and that I've referenced in Spain. But let's not forget that there are over 10 million 9-litre cases of gin sold in the US in 2023. So that's double the volume sold in the UK.
Wow. Okay. It's pretty good.
And so that, let's just put that into our equivalent serve. So that's 2.6 billion serves of gin in 2023 in the US.
Okay, so we know that, as always, there was a fundamental change that helped drive the growth. In the UK, it was the repeal of old gin laws. But what was happening in the market that drove the growth we saw in the years up to 2020 that Helen observed?
Okay, so if we think about the UK, where she's based, we particularly saw an acceleration or growth in flavoured gins.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, so then when you kind of look at the back bars in pubs and bars in the UK and you're looking in retailers, what you suddenly saw was just this much broader selection of different types and styles of gins. And they really grew, the flavoured gins in particular really grew, but again peaked and are now in 2024 about half the volume flavoured gins in the UK that they were at that peak in 2020.
So it was flavoured gin then that really drove the gin momentum that we saw from 2010 to about 2020 in key markets like Spain and the UK.
Yeah, but to the comment I was just making earlier, I'd also suggest that a lot of this growth came from salience. So you know me, Felicity, it's one of my favourite marketing concepts or business concepts to talk about.
Indeed I do, Lily. So I'm going to invite you to do a quick recap on what salience is.
Well, thank you, Felicity. So salience is awareness. So you being aware of the brand or the product category, gin in this case. But it's also about that awareness at the point of purchase. So it's I know it, but I'm also, it's mentally and physically available to me when I'm making that purchase decision. So we know from all of the extensive data that's released by Kantar, so from multiple categories and in multiple markets around the world, that the biggest correlating factor for brand or category growth in this sense is salience. So the more salience you have, the more you'll grow. So if we think about that, that's kind of stating the bleeding obvious. You kind of need to be aware of it, and it needs to be front and centre and available at that point of purchase. So we need that mental and physical availability. And that kind of trumps other factors in terms of driving consumer behaviour and also driving what is successful and what grows from a brand or category point of view. So to the point I was making earlier, if you walked into a pub, say in 2017, 2018 in the UK, you will have been hit by a wall of different gins that were physically available to you in front of you, driving that salience. So I think that's part of what also sort of helped the category to grow in the way that it did. But Felicity, you mentioned, I want to go back to something, because you mentioned right at the beginning that you were drinking more zero alcohol gin. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Okay. So this whole market of non-alcoholic spirit analogs really begins with the emergence of something called Seedlip. And it's an interesting story. So I read an interview with Ben Branson, who was the founder. It was done by Vogue. And he said he developed it after he asked for a non-alcoholic drink in a restaurant and they gave him a really nasty sugary mocktail. But it just so happened that he'd already been reading a book called The Art of Distillation from 1651. And
wow.
He'd been playing around with just, he
as
also,
you do.
Yeah, well, he also knew about taxidermy. He said, But anyway, so it's an interesting character. So he was distilling botanicals in his kitchen. So he was really the right person at the right time. So he began to develop Seedlip in 2013. And 2 years later, he sold his first 1,000 bottles into the London department store Selfridges.
Yeah, yeah. So that's Seedlip's, the brand that was later acquired by Diageo.
That's right. And so really that was the start of what we now see as the zero alcohol boom. So, Lily, how big is the non-alc side of things?
Well, in spirits, so zero alcohol, non-alcohol spirits is still relatively speaking pretty small. So it's less than 1% globally of the overall spirit market. Again, IWSR data. The largest volume by, absolute volume, being for zero alcohol spirits being in the US, followed by Germany and then the UK. So perhaps it's you helping out in Germany, Felicity, on those numbers.
I think I'm single-handedly holding up the market, to be honest. I accept that.
Yeah.
All right. So what do you think the future holds for gin, Lily?
Okay, so I think we'll see some growth, but it will be in some of these other markets I was talking about, particularly through craft and local gin production, to your point about Icelandic
yes.
gin? Yeah. The Icelandic botanicals, so I think we'll see more of that. I think interestingly, actually, we'll see potentially gin featuring more in RTDs, so in the kind of ready-to-drink pre-mixed. And I say that because if you look at, again, IWSR data from a category perspective, the only category, beverage alcohol category, that's forecast to grow over the next 4 or 5 years is actually the RTD category. Grow at a reasonable level. So I'm wondering whether we'll see more gin-based RTDs, kind of pre-mixed cocktails. So, you know, things like, in February this year, the rappers Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg launched their what they call subtly carbonated.
Subtly carbonated. I love subtly carbonated.
I don't know. It's like a few bits of fizz.
A few bubbles here and there.
Anyway, it's called Gin and Juice and was released to be timed with the 30 years since the song of the same name came out. So launched in February, by July, Gin and Juice has exploded onto the UK market via nearly 1,000 independent retailers, as well as on-trade locations and music festivals. And their range of gin-based ready-to-drink cocktails is available in flavours like like apricot, citrus, melon, and passion fruit. Felicity,
far be it from me to criticise anybody's taste, but apricot and passion fruit, I think I'll stick to Tanqueray 00. Mm. Okay. By the way, something I want to know is, why has the gin and tonic never taken off in the US the way it has in other markets?
Okay, so we talked about the US earlier. It has been kind of steady, small growth in the US, but let's not forget those volumes I was talking about, simply based on market size. But if we also think about the US, you know, it historically and even more recently, it has been a very beer dominated market. So, you know, proportionally, we have a higher proportion of beer drinkers than we do in some other markets. And then more recently, so if we're looking over the past few years, we've seen a really significant uptake in RTDs. So I was talking about RTDs, ready to drinks, and a lot of that being hard seltzer based in the US, and more recently, tequila and mezcal. So I think it's not that the US is rejecting gin and tonic, but it's just that the kind of culture and the market drivers are coming from different places.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, about how much these drinks aren't really about flavour. They're just often about history and culture as much as they are about that. You know, we think everything is about taste, and quite often it's not. But I have to say, in the end, I understand their embrace of tequila, but gin is better.
Yeah, so I guess that means you're not a margarita drinker then, Misty.
Okay, so I've got a confession. Do you know what? In my whole life, I have never actually tried a margarita.
What? What? Yeah. How is that possible, Felicity? Okay, so that's your podcast homework. Please go and try a Christmas margarita. Go and have one for Christmas, and then you can tell me all about it.
Why?
Because, well, did you know margarita is the most popular cocktail in the world, Felicity?
You're kidding. All right, all right. I will do that, only because I've been told that I must go to the bar and order a margarita. I have my orders. In the meantime, if you could survey more of your many friends and get some more questions from them for future episodes. Mm. And until then, this has been A Question of Drinks.
See you next time, Felicity, post-margarita.
See you, Luli.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.